Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A6NZ podcast. This episode continues our podcast road trip to Washington, D.C., which took place earlier this month in conjunction with our annual Tech Policy Summit. Today's topic is all about the blockchain in Congress, moderated by A6NZ policy team partner Matthew Colford.
We're recording from Capitol Hill. I'm here with Congressman Jared Polis from Colorado and Congressman David Schweikert from Arizona, along with Mike Lempres, who's the Chief Legal and Risk Officer for Coinbase. So let's get started. What is the average perception among members of Congress of blockchain and cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin?
Well, this is Jared Polis. I think people still turn their heads and say, what's that? I think there's some awareness of Bitcoin, for instance, or online currencies. But outside of our caucus members and perhaps a few members of Congress that have an engineering or computer science background, I don't think we're quite there yet in explaining what this is to people.
Yeah, it's one of our great difficulties is so often when we actually say, hey, distributed ledger can provide all these types of solutions in our society, they immediately want to talk about Bitcoin. And, you know, that's both wonderful, but at the same time, the underlying technology is so much broader than just a cryptocurrency. And trying to walk through saying, okay, let me explain the stamping of nodes and, you know, the matching and permission and levels of permission. And you get a couple moments and Jared and I get into that, and about 2 minutes into it, they're just staring at us.
So, and I assume a lot of people, when you say Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, the first thing they think about is this dark web. Or if you say blockchain, like the first thing they think about.
Well,
is,
and it might not even be that sophisticated. Really? Keep in mind the demographics around here. I mean, we have a tough time explaining cloud computing. Right. I mean, you know, this is a challenge. No, what members of Congress have, though, is they have talented staffs of 20-somethings that get this stuff a little bit more. Now, many of them are not hard science people, yeah, but they've lived that era in their lives. And so they certainly do get that. And hopefully it's their job to kind of explain that to the member of Congress or senator they work for.
And one of the things I think we're starting to succeed at is explaining the benefits. You know, you may be carrying around that supercomputer in your pocket you call an iPhone. You don't know how it actually works. You just know the benefits of its utilization. You know, we used to actually try to do on the whiteboard the description of how a series of nodes actually talk to each other and how it stamps in time and those things. And I realized there's no reason for that. You just now explain, here's the benefit.
Right. Concrete examples. So, well, it's interesting, Mike. So this gets to a little bit what you guys are working on, because at Coinbase, you guys are simultaneously trying to make the case to the government, but then also to the public at large. So what is the narrative that you guys have been working on as far as explaining what Bitcoin is to the general population?
So it's very similar to the same message you give to Congress or to anybody else, which is there are benefits to this. You don't need, as Congressman Schweikert was just saying, you don't need to be an expert in the underlying technology to know the benefits from it. There are these benefits, and there are trusted companies, and realize that, you know, you're going to be protected as a consumer, that you have access to these benefits.
So let's talk a little bit about how the Blockchain Caucus came to be, because I think even our DC audience is probably like, what? There's a Congressional Blockchain Caucus? So
let's start with what a caucus is. So
I mean,
outside of DC,
so basically
this is a formalized group that members of Congress can organize under to help educate others. So it's like forming a club in college, right? You want to be juggling, you start a juggling club, and you know, all of a sudden you have a recognized group. So we're able to take out rooms here, rent rooms for briefings, all of that sort of thing in the Capitol. So, and there's a number of these. There's hundreds of these caucuses. So there was none in this area. There was no effort or way or manner of educating our colleagues about blockchain. So we really got together and said, look, let's formalize it so we can take out rooms and do briefings, which is effectively what that means, and provide a forum for other members to learn more about the blockchain.
Yeah. And look, I'm partially in it because it was the only club that would have me.
I suspect you're in some others as well.
Yeah. Well, I was president of my math club. There is a benefit to it because what will often happen is we worked on a concept for using blockchain or distributed ledger for scheduling at the VA to deal with the fraud issues of people were sneaking in, changing the schedules, and the benefit of, hey, there's a timestamp. You know who touched it, when, and it would get rid of that problem. But if you present that as an idea to the VA committee, you get stared at. If you present it saying, hey, as the blockchain distributed ledger caucus, we've been working on solutions in society. Here's an example. It just has a little more gravitas.
So you spent time at DOJ, yep, a while ago, but do you get the sense that there's the same interest on the executive branch side? Are there these miniature kind of, not interest groups, but sort of clubs and groups that are getting together to talk about this on the executive branch side?
I mean, even more so, I think, on the executive branch side. But I just want to stress, we called it a club, and it is a club, but it's very, very important, right? I mean, the main thing we want to do is make sure that Congress is aware of what we do, has no reason to be afraid of it, and understands broadly what's going on. And the reason for that is it helps put things in perspective when an event, good or bad, occurs. It makes them aware of other options that are out there. It's not the first time they hear about it when something comes up, which is really important for Congress. With regard to the executive branch, some of them are involved actively in either regulating our space today or considering regulating our space today. And those agencies are clearly very involved, and some of them are very expert. I will say, however, that it's a big executive branch, and if you look at it as a percentage of the entire executive branch, it's a very small percentage. But again, there are experts there who are looking at it.
And there's also a concern on some of our parts that it not be seen just as the cryptocurrency platform. And 10 minutes ago in our office, we had a number of folks talking about, could we dramatically change the cost of the transmission, the movement of value. You walk into a retailer and swipe a debit card, the way it's transmitted and cleared, could we reduce the cost? Well, that would be good for society. The Uber driver, the peace worker who wants to put aside 25 cents every time they finished a drive or a project, could we dramatically lower the cost using a blockchain encrypted network to move value from one end to the other? All of a sudden makes doing sort of micro savings towards your future retirement possible. And so it's trying to come and say there are societal solutions that this technology, if it's understood, can provide.
Well, this is what's so interesting to me is that oftentimes you look at the federal government's efforts to catch up to modern day technology. It's really just an effort to catch up to the status quo, whereas a lot of the conversation that you guys are having is really leapfrogging the existing infrastructure or thinking about how to create entirely new frameworks for thinking about these things, not just catching up to where we are. But if you think about it, the blockchain is this relatively new concept, at least for most people. And so it's a much more forward-leaning position than other tech caucuses in Congress, like the Modernizing IT caucus.
I guess
or
I think what you're
like
saying,
that.
This is more fundamentally disruptive that yes,
totally.
than some of the others, in that we don't even know who or what the players will be and where it will impact. It has massive ramifications in the developing world for the unbanked and the untitled. So, I mean, there's identity confirmation and frankly, tying into policy interests like identity ownership, allowing consumers to really control and own their own identity. So there's vast ramifications. Many of them touch law and tax policy, and that's one of the reasons that we have to pay attention. Absent a deliberate effort to create a legal ecosystem that allows for innovation, it's quite possible that efforts to do innovative things will run afoul of current law.
Well, that sound that you hear, that ringing noise, that bell is letting the congressman know that the House is back in session. And that they have to be there in 15 minutes.
What Jared just said is incredibly important. Time and time again, we've been playing with ideas of own your own information. You know, do you as a citizen, should you actually have the right to own all the data and then sort of create a societal lease to government to look at it? But should you know if the IRS is looking at you or the FBI is looking at you or a single point where your university transcripts are? And some of that is a little bit techno-utopian, but think about how much easier your life would be, A, being able to have your government-held information in a single portal, and then the elegance of being able to see a stamp that knowing if someone was looking at you. So there are these things, but that is very disruptive sort of in the current legal framework, sort of creating a new societal contract in what is privacy, what is government use. So these things, they're coming.
And this also is very exciting in kind of a left-right alliance, and both of us represent different sides of the spectrum, because there's an enormous distrust on both sides of government with private information. And the last thing we want from either the left or the right is a government that controls your information, has access to your information, and can dispense your information to others. Many on the left, like myself, don't want corporations to play that role either. But frankly, the blockchain is a way to address both of those concerns from the left and the right.
Yeah. And there's this sort of magic circle where those of us who may be slightly more libertarian leaning and those who may be, so we sort of come together on some of the civil libertarian and the right to control and own your information.
And the decentralized, you know, nature of blockchain is something that's just beautiful. It's a beautiful thing, regardless of where you sit on the ideological spectrum.
And is the way that you guys make these arguments to your colleagues? Is it the same way that you make these kinds of arguments to your constituents?
Well,
to what extent do you make these arguments to your constituents and say, look, these are all the benefits of the blockchain, of blockchain technology. There should be more kind of pressure from the bottom up for the federal government to act on this.
Right? We have companies in my state, in my district, working on blockchain technologies, startups, mid-stage companies. They're very excited that they have an ear, not only in their member of Congress, but through the caucus. I mean, these are not the kind of issues that would come up in kind of a mass town hall. There's other things on people's minds, but, you know, I'm always excited when they do. Yeah. Occasionally they do.
Yeah. And look, the ability to meet with a constituent and say, let me walk you through, there is an elegant solution that may not have been discussed. And there is often a technology solution. For many of us, one of the greatest frustrations here in Congress is how many problems that we see come in front of us. And there's actually a technology solution if you just take a step back and think it through, whether it be, you know, fraud at the IRS or helping people be able to get certain benefits. There are technology solutions once you sort of drive through the bureaucratic layers.
Mike, what about Natherton?
Oh, there you go.
So Mike, in addition to being the chief legal and risk officer at Coinbase, is also the mayor of Atherton, California, which is a pretty tech savvy town, generally. Lots of tech employees, tech executives. What is the perception of blockchain and cryptocurrency?
Well, I think our blockchain literacy is much, much higher in the heart of Silicon Valley than it is in most of the rest of the world. And so it is a different conversation you have there. People do see the benefits, and there's less fear of an unknown technology. It's the way it works. I will say out there that there is a concern about the role of government in this process, and that it's important the federal government learn more about what's going on. Congress and the executive branch understand it better and take advantage of possible applications like David's talking about. There's some great uses the government could save tremendous money. It could expand privacy rights. Tremendous amount could be done with blockchain technology. But I will say, with my constituents as a mayor of a small town in California, there's a concern that a misstep by the government could also squish it.
I would share that concern, and I wouldn't even call it a misstep, because we know when there's any fundamentally disruptive technology, there's a bunch of incumbents and legacy operators that come to this town to try to co-opt government to sustain their advantage. And that we've seen that in every space. I expect it to occur here too. So it's very legitimate fear.
No, it look, incredibly important. But if I came to you, and let's just use a life example that's happening, I think, in both of our states. An autonomous vehicle has an accident in your neighborhood. Who do you sue? Well, you actually sue the code. But what would make that code insurable? If the code were held in a distributive ledger, you know that if someone touched it, it has a timestamp. You know that the code is the code that was involved in the accident. And that's not esoteric. This is about to change a lot of our lives over the next decade. You know, and the concept of being able to insure an autonomous vehicle's code is possible in a distributive ledger. And that's just sort of the classic sort of creative thinking of, we know this technology is coming, but how do we make it fit into our current legal framework? And there was a solution.
I will say that technology is coming more quickly than people think.
Yeah, yeah.
When David talks about a decade, some of this stuff is going to happen much more quickly. It's happening today, and it's going to continue to happen. The rate's going to accelerate.
So, Mike, that's a government perspective. What would be the industry perspective on risk and compliance issues?
I can say, certainly in Coinbase, we believe there has to be, the space has to be regulated. There has to be trust in the space. And in order for people to have, consumers and others to have trust in the space, there has to be a layer of regulation so people know the rules are being followed. No one's got an advantage. That's very important. I should take a step back, though. We are here in the capital of the federal government, but this is a space that still is largely, in many ways, regulated by state governments. And that's really important. And there's a whole issue about the state role versus the federal role. And I don't think that's an easy issue. I mean, one of the nice things in an emerging technology space is if you have 55 different state jurisdictions because of territories and things like that. Looking at it, if somebody makes a misstep, we can correct, or people can, the states actually can serve as a laboratory to learn from each other. Whereas when the federal government acts, it's a giant step in one direction or another.
Why is the lag here between where the technology is and the interest from the government side so much shorter maybe than it is for other technologies? In other words,
perhaps because some of the implications are for the public sector itself and public sector goals. So I think when things are developed by themselves completely outside of that, it takes longer for the public sector to notice. But frankly, many of the things we do publicly, whether it's taxes, whether it's titling, whether it's a variety of purposes that we are public functions, are directly affected. And there's great potential for efficiency improvements through blockchain.
Look, there's a brilliant example here. Arizona's legislature about 3-4 weeks ago actually put into the state commercial code smart contracts and recognition of distributed ledger. So there's already some discussion there saying who's going to be the person that shows up to the motor vehicle department and says, we're going to take all vehicle and equipment titling and just put it on a chain, and you'll be able to transfer ownership of vehicles on your phone now instead of ever having to go to a DMV office. In Arizona, it would be legal now for a county to try to take its real estate ownership records and put them on a distributive ledger. So it's a brilliant example of titling meeting the willingness of states and local jurisdictions to actually be much more creative than trying to move the monolith that the federal government is.
That's great. It gets back to what Mike was saying about the states really driving this in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the reasons I think that the governments generally are engaged so early in the process is that this is a hugely disruptive technology. And the spaces it disrupts include spaces that are really important to individual consumers and are in roles that are often either themselves in very, very heavily regulated spaces or actually performed by a government. And those are some of the spaces that are going to get disrupted.
So in the time we have left, let's talk a little bit about the next 5 to 10 years. There's certainly a sense among some people in Silicon Valley, at least, that this is just going to take some time to catch on. But once it does, we're going to look back and we're going to go, how could we have been so foolish to think that, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrencies and all the other applications were not going to be central to our future. What does the next 5 to 10 years look like from your perspective, Mike?
Dog years. So, you know, 5 to 10 years is, you know, we should think more like that. That's 35 normal years or something like that. Things are happening very quickly in the space. And I do think that the changes are going to come. They'll be led by technology and government will be chasing. And I actually think that's entirely appropriate. There's a need for regulatory compliance, obviously, to fit in that. I think it won't be 10 years. I think in 5 years, we'll look back and be surprised at how much the world changed, much, you know, similar to something like the iPhone or the internet itself, how quickly things changed in response to that.
We have no idea 5 or 10 years. However, what we've seen today is a lot of venture capital and funds flowing into this industry, funding all sorts of innovation. I mean, I've met with firms that, you know, invested in 20, 30 companies. And by the way, those they don't know which way it's headed either. That's why they're doing 20 or 30 companies. They're hoping that one of them is the next, you know, all-encompassing blockchain success story. So nobody really knows. But when we see all this innovation and funding behind it, when the dust settles, there's going to be some great winners out there. Now, if any of us knew who they would be, we're probably in the wrong room because we'll be, you know, we'd be best rewarded to be somewhere else right now.
Yeah. And look, this is sort of goes back to the beginning of the conversation. Most of the consumers, most of government isn't going to need to know that it's running on a distributive ledger rails. They're just going to be interested in saying, hey, did we work with NIST to create a security standard so we could all carry our medical records personally on our phone, even though it would probably be on a distributive ledger chain in the background. That right there is a great societal good. It would help us all with medical costs. It's not right or left. It's just the embracing of technology. And that could happen actually almost today and solve a huge societal problem if we could build the framework saying medical records meet the HIPAA standards. If you do this type of encryption or maybe this type of token on a blockchain, go, let's have it. So it may happen much faster because of our need policy-wise to come up with some solutions.
Fascinating. This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to close with a quick lightning round. So if each of you could respond in, you know, 10 seconds or less. So favorite blog or publication that keeps you up to date on blockchain issues?
CoinDesk.
I just read the Reddit subreddits on Bitcoin.
Oh, I'm one of those that has a whole chain of them on his phone. So you start in the morning with, you know, TechCrunch and move on to CoinDesk and just on and on and on and on. What has been also interesting is how often this discussion is now popping up on more mainstream publications like the Wall Street Journal, which is a great sign.
Okay, most underappreciated application of blockchain technology. There's so many, but if you had to pick one that you just think the public isn't even aware of how much of a benefit this could be.
I would say the ability to control your own data and know who touches it.
Yeah, that's not underrated. That's a great one. I mean, that one is an overarching one that accomplishes public policy goals on the left and the right at the same time. It's great, and American consumers demand it.
I think global benefits for the unbanked are enormous. Yeah. It's going to change the world.
I'm tired of us wanting to help a poor family.
That's a great idea.
A poor family in central Myanmar and having the money basically stolen by
dictators,
bureaucrats, and this. And that. Say, let's help build a network where I can buy something from that person. They can sell me something, and the chain is the distribution of the value to their phone.
It's
It's a much more elegant human-to-human way to help the poor around the world than supporting bad governments.
But that's one incredibly exciting application that you could see. We could actually do that today, given there's some, I'm sure, regulatory and legal issues, but we could do it today.
The greatest battle today is the threat to the current bureaucracies. Whether it be on the right or the left, you often defend your own personal income stream, your own job, your own bureaucracy. And it's hard to say, hey, this is a great idea. You just put my entire department out of business, but you actually helped poor people around the world.
Right.
So those of us in the policy world, we have to be willing to do those really hard things and say, you guys are great, but you actually are a barrier to the ultimate goal.
Fantastic. All right. I think that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you all. Thank you, Congressman Schweiker, Congressman Polis, and Mike. This was a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
This is always fun.
Thank you.